Hi, and welcome once again to From the Center, a podcast by the Center for Western Studies. I'm Jack Vowell, on faculty at the Center for Western Studies, joined as always by my friend and colleague, the director for the Center of Western Studies, John Hodges. Sir, how you doing?
I'm well, Jack. I'm well. Glad to see you. We're mourning the loss of R. Higgins.
Mm-hmm.
It was just last week, probably, that we had to let him go. And so that's a sad day, and so we're dogless now, and that makes a hole in our hearts and in our homes.
Doggled. Yes, I don't even know what that word means, but it sounded right.
Well, he's been a mascot for the center for, I don't know, ever since we started, I guess.
Basically.
Yeah.
He's been the mascot, morale officer.
It's true.
Diplomat to Albania. Interesting enough. He's very persuasive.
He had a way of just looking at you.
He
could just talk you into things without saying a word. It's a real art, you know.
It is real art. Yeah. He just could add the stare.
Well, he was a good friend, and he'll be missed by the students, I think, too. Although the students haven't known him long enough to miss him, exactly. I think this, since we just started the year, but past students have gotten in touch with me and said, oh, no, he was such a big part of their year.
Fortunately, this year's students... I say fortunately. It's sort of fortunately, unfortunately, this year students did not get a good taste of Higgins.
Yeah.
So on one hand, they missed Higgins, but on the other hand, they won't miss him.
They don't know what they're missing.
They don't know what they're missing.
Yeah,
so
that's right.
That's good.
Well, that's true. But apart from that, everything's well. God is good, and we've had a great year so far. We've been reading in Homer, as you know, and Abolition of Man, and it's been a good time. We've had some good conversations on Sunday nights, too, haven't we?
Yes, we have.
Yeah. Last week we talked about, or two Sundays ago, I guess, we talked about engagement with the culture.
Right.
And then did the podcast last week about it.
Right, where we talked about, we had the two statements, the PAC statement and the MacArthur statement.
Right.
Both of them statements about social justice, both of them at odds with each other. The MacArthur statement basically said that social justice is... baked into the cake of social justice is a bunch of Gramscian Marxist stuff that is not conducive to the gospel, is actually antithetical to the gospel, and we don't need that exactly. And the PAC statement basically said, how dare you, social justice is built into the gospel because we're supposed to, be salt and light, and we're supposed to, true religion is caring for the widows and orphans and so on and so forth.
That's right.
And
that's
some
right.
other things that was liberal claptrap, but there was a, between the two, there was a tension, and that was, on the one hand, we disagreed with the kind of progressivist nonsense, if I'm not really being nice about it, but it's just the nonsense about the way they viewed Jesus and about the way they viewed Orthodox faith and their view of sexuality and stuff, which is really just informed by fads of the culture.
Right.
But on the other hand, the MacArthur statement seemed to have a very negative view of Christian involvement in culture. And by negative, I don't mean that it said you shouldn't, but rather, it seemed there was an absence of any declarative, this is how you engage in culture.
Right.
Right?
Right.
And I've mentioned, I think at the Sunday night you're talking about from 2 weeks ago, I mentioned how frustrating it seems that the side of the discussion that is grounded in Orthodox faith, in the scriptural, creedal, or historical faith, it seems like over the last, 100 years maybe, or less, that there's been a kind of vacuum on our side of, like, how do you engage culture? That when I say vacuum, I don't necessarily mean there weren't people out there saying this is how I engage culture. There were, or even doing it. There were plenty of people who were doing it. There were Lewis's, there were Schaeffer's, and probably thousands upon thousands of people whose names we don't know, right?
Right.
But as far as, like, an organized effort that seemed to have, like, one united voice that could clearly state itself, this is where we are, it always seemed like that wasn't there, and thus that's the vacuum. And that vacuum seems to be filled by what honestly is a Marxist-influenced view of society and view of humans. And because of that, when Christians want to get socially involved, so to speak, it seems like inevitably they're going to run into those terms and wind up using those terms because it's so saturated academic and intellectual life for so long in regards to social issues that there is no other way to talk about it. And so it raised the question of, well, how, we're Orthodox, creedal, scriptural Christians who follow the historical faith. What is a positive vision of engaging culture?
Right.
Now, not just a bunch of declarations of we're against Marxism, but well, okay, if we're not going to engage the culture as Marxists in some way, shape, or form, then how are we going to do it?
And that's a problem in many other places, too, in the sense that we can't very well proclaim what we believe by what we don't believe.
Right.
The kind of negative approach, right? I don't do this and I don't do that. This is how I define my spiritual maturity. I don't go to movies, or I don't, you know, play cards, or I don't drink, or I don't whatever. And there are a lot of things that we probably don't want to do as Christians. It's true, but you can't define your holiness based on what you don't do. It has to be on what you do do. It has to be on the positive side. Just as Lewis says in that, Weight of Glory, where he talks about the difference between unselfishness and charity, mm-hmm. right? Unselfishness is the lack of a negative thing. Yes, selfishness is a negative. So unselfishness is a virtue, is the lack of a negative thing, whereas charity is the presence of a positive thing, and that's what we're looking for here.
Right.
So in the same sort of framework, we want to say, it's not enough to just say how I don't engage the culture. It has to be how do I help in a healthy way engage the culture. There's another aspect of it too that I want to bring up at the beginning here, and that is that I think theologically we disagree sometimes. I don't mean you and me. I mean the world, the Christian world, disagrees on how much engagement is appropriate. Somehow, it's not just a matter of a kind of self-righteousness that I don't do this or that or the other thing, but rather that really doesn't matter. You know, it's not important for me to say vote or have an opinion about divorce or whatever. I just need to live out my Christian life in a kind of monastic, removed way from the culture. And then other theological positions are that we need to be engaged with it, and salt, being salt and light, means being, you know, taking up these roles and taking up jobs in the culture and working those things out. And so sometimes I think it's actually a theological idea. You know, there are certain churches that are far more willing to separate themselves from the culture and think that they're doing a good thing by doing so, and that leads to some of those negative things. But it does leave a vacuum in the culture, doesn't it?
It does.
Yeah.
And what you're talking about, I've heard before, when it comes to engaging the culture, the church, at least in America, has usually had three responses. One is a sort of bunker mentality, which is, I guess, the monastic approach. This is not a knock on the Benedict option or something like that. I'm just saying that there is a kind of bunker and hunker down, you know, and just sort of try and survive and let the wild world go on around you.
That's right.
Because there's no way to engage with it without it corrupting you utterly.
Right. And that it's all going to burn anyway. So why bother building in a place where it's all going to be destroyed? Right.
And that the verbiage of that was a bit in the MacArthur statement of, like, you know, and people who have defended it. Not that this is all going to burn, so it doesn't matter. But this notion of we're supposed to focus on eternal things, not temporal things. Therefore,
that's right.
Something. Right. Yeah, so that's right. Like, they'll quote that.
These things are temporal, and so they don't.
Right. Another way is not necessarily the hunker and bunker down, but it's something that is kind of similar to it. And it's where you engage the culture, but you engage it from the premises of your own subculture that you've created.
Uh-huh.
So, like, the hunker and bunker down may create their own sort of private little culture. But then there's a kind where, well, we're going to engage culture by writing our own books and making our own movies and having our own bookstores and stuff that's out there. But really, if you go and watch and read and listen to that, having our own art, musical artists, but in our own award shows.
Right.
But if you go out there and you actually read and listen and see what they're doing, it's really by Christians for Christians. Like, it's still this inward thing. And if they ever engage culture, it's always reactionary. It's always like throwing stones from behind their fortress wall.
Right.
So it's like they're still bunkered down, but they'll just pop their heads up every once in a while to be like, you know, in your general direction, you know, stuff like that. They'll basically,
your mother was a hamster.
And if, you know, the culture gets too close, they're like, fetch a lavash, you know.
Right, exactly.
That's basically it. So that's their level of engagement.
Fetch a lavash.
That's their level of engagement. It's like, we're still behind our bunkered walls, but we'll pop our head up to, like, sneer.
Yeah.
You know, like, what's going on.
That's an engagement, isn't it?
Sneering. That's an engagement. And then the third way, so it's like the hunker and bunker down, and then there's like the sneering from the fortress walls. And then the third way is a just complete and total compromise and capitulation with culture.
Oh, yeah.
Like, right. No, this is how we engage culture, by basically agreeing with everything and becoming indistinguishable from it.
Uh-huh.
Like, there was a Babylon Bee article that's title was Success. This Christian is completely indistinguishable from the culture. And it was just a guy, it just looked like this hipsterish dude. He had like two like finger guns, just like, hey.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Like, he finally did it. And it was just
hip glasses and a tattoo.
So you could say that's sort of, honestly, even though that's 3 points, it is really like two, because there's one side that says, we hunker down, and if we have any engagement with the culture, it's always kind of reactionary.
That's right. Sounds like
away.
The first two are almost the same.
As one Catholic guy put it, if you'll allow me to put it this way, as my bad Catholic guy put it, so he said, you want to like put your children, wife and children behind you and back away from the culture with both middle fingers raised.
Oh,
just
wow.
As you like back away from it. Like, that's the attitude. Like, stay away. Like, stay away. You know, pull out the porcupine quills and stay away.
Yeah.
And the other, because the argument goes, there is no way to engage culture in any meaningful or deep way without that culture having some cross-pollination with you, and there being some way that the gospel gets contaminated. And I think that's really the crux of the matter, is how do you keep the gospel from being watered down or contaminated? Because, I mean, that's in Scripture, Paul and Peter, too, most of the letters written in the New Testament are combating some way in which the gospel has been contaminated in some way by the culture, you know, from some legalistic Judaizers, you know, some Jewish sense left into it, or some Gnostics, or some libertines who think that grace means they can just do whatever they want, all kinds of false teachers that are twisting the gospel in certain ways, and they're constantly having to fight against that stuff.
There really are a lot of ways you can fall off of the horse of the gospel. You can fall left or right or up or down, this way, that way. But there's only one kind of way that's the wildness, as Chesterton puts it, of orthodoxy. I think what you're describing is what the church has always had the problem with, of being in the culture and not of it, because you want you want engagement, but you don't want a capitulation, and you want being not of it, you want withdrawal from it, but maybe that's the wrong word, you want to be separate from it in a sense, but you don't want to withdraw from it,
so
the two are very, it's difficult to find that balance.
The key example for me, and the thing I always fall back on, and because tons of people have fallen back on it, so it's nothing new, but the same Paul who was constantly having to deal with, you know, perversions of the gospel from the outside culture had the moment on Mars Hill. Right?
Yes, right.
And
right.
It's such a significant moment because I think, technically speaking, he never quoted what for him would be scripture like once. Like he never quoted it once. Instead, he spoke in categories they would understand and even quoted their own pagan poets.
Their own poets, exactly.
Right?
Something they would know.
And yet what he was doing was still thoroughly Christian. It was a Christian worldview spoken in their language.
That's right. That's a very good example.
And so it's like, how to do that without capitulation to the culture in some way? And this is where I think some of the frustration may come in. I think we mentioned this back in the Revoice conference even, that the Revoice conference, one of their problems, it seems, is the verbiage and the terminology they were using was drenched in a certain sort of was drenched in a school of thought that comes from a particular ideology that a lot of Christians find, Marxist thinking, somewhere back there, either Marxist or Marxist influenced. And because of that, it's like, well, if you use that terminology at all, then it's a problem. And thus, if we see the word social justice, then the hackles are supposed to rise immediately, which creates problems then when you have Christians who aren't Marxist, but they want to get involved. And they know that social justice is like terminology of being involved. So they're like, okay, well, I care about social justice. Well, now there's probably people out there who think you're a Marxist now, or you're contaminated the gospel. So
it's interesting that that it all boils down to language in the end. I know that's what you're studying your PhD about, the way language works in a postmodern context. Mm-hmm. But we do have definitions of things, and if we're not on the same page, as it were, with the definition, then all sorts of confusion can happen. And but it's the action of actually taking a term like social justice or something like that, taking that term and then trying to engage with it from a Christian perspective is actually the problem of engaging with the culture that we're talking about, because you're gonna you're either going to allow it to stand as it is and mold yourself to it to a degree, or you're going to ask it to come to join you on your side of the definition line. And in either case, using the same term in a large setting is going to be misunderstood by somebody along the way. So it's funny. It's just funny to me. This may or may not be interesting to carry on with our. This may be a tangent, in other words. But in the end, it's like in the beginning. That is, in the beginning was the word. See, right. And so as I'm saying now, in the end, it's all about the word. Yeah. It's all about how we understand the definition of the term. And is there a definition for the term that stands outside of all of our collective understanding?
Yeah, I think we talked about a vacuum earlier, and I think it might be more accurate to describe that vacuum as a vacuum of definition and terminology.
Yeah. Well, if you don't have those things, then it's very hard to then populate that vacuum, to get into that vacuum and make sense of it.
It's hard because it's hard to then articulate exactly what you're doing and why it matters.
That's right.
You know, it's like, like the, you know, it is not for nothing that, you know, Marxist style thinking has so influenced all the culture. And when I say that, I'm not talking conspiratorially or paranoid. That's just a fact. Okay, it's a fact that so much of academic...
I know, the Bilderbergs, they're in the behind
you. Yeah, I know.
I know, you're thinking...
Sometimes cultural Marxism is another one of those things that can sound like, you know, definitionally can sound like the Priory of Zion
yes,
or something like that.
Right, that's right.
What I mean is just the simple fact that most academic institutions were influenced by Gramscian Marxism, Frankfurt School Marxism, Althusserian Marxism... and things that were influenced by all that, from like Foucault's ideas about discourse to Derrida's ideas about language to just the Sartre's ideas about human beings and existence. It's all, if not directly Marxist, it's influenced by Marxism, or it's Marxist soaked in some way.
Right.
And so the thing is that that thing's been brewing and going for around, has been in intellectual circles for so long that it's built up an entire terminological apparatus by which it can articulate what it's doing. When it diagnoses the ills of culture, it has all the words and all the ways to put it so that it feels like you have something.
Right.
Well, there's a way that's engaging culture. If you step over outside of it, outside of that Marxist terminology, it's like, well, what other terminology do you have?
Right.
And it just doesn't seem like there was anything there. Again, there were plenty of people who were engaging culture who were not Marxist and who were more orthodox and creedal and scriptural in the way they were doing things.
Yeah.
But for some reason, there just wasn't this massive, I don't know, school of thought that influenced so much that it created a bunch of terminology that just soaked into that side. And thus there was a vacuum, I think, of definition and terminology that the other side filled.
Well, then I think what we're really talking about is the vacuum that's created in the Western culture by the loss of God altogether, and belief in God, let's say.
Sure.
Because there is another system. There is another system, but it's Christian, right? Or you could say Judeo-Christian if you want to. And there is a language, and there is a system, there is a structure, but that system and structure has lost its ability to compel somehow. Mm-hmm. And that's where the vacuum happens. And it's not surprising then that that vacuum would be filled by something that is a kind of pseudo-religion, because I think Marxism actually is a substitute for religion. It's a religious position. It's an atheistic religion.
It's an entire worldview.
It is. And it's no wonder that it has the capacity to win the hearts of thoughtful people in some ways, you know, because if you don't find the Christian view compelling, nihilism is simply not compelling. It's not, you know, you can for a moment you can think, hey, that's got to be how it is.
Right. And you may have some sort of romantic view.
It is a kind of romanticized reality that way, but you can't live there, not continue to breathe.
Right.
So, or eat, or, you know, love, or any of the sort of basic things.
Go through the drive-thru at the fast food.
Well, yeah. Yeah, that's right. So that's not a possibility. So when a system comes along that is a possibility like that, it has adherence for a reason. So I think, and the essence of that, if we can sort of put it down on tape here, is people don't use tape anymore.
No.
It's that you can, what you do is you find a division. You put a division between two groups, say, peoples, types of people, thoughts, and then you pit those two things against each other. And in doing that, you take your eye off of the kind of unity that you're hoping for. Well, let's say that's not the right way to put that. What you do is you take your eye off of God, certainly, and you put it on the sort of moral pressure of the righteousness of one side or the other in that debate. You can see it happening in homosexual marriage debates. You can see it happening politics about, say, the immigration debates. You know, so there are people that are on this side, there are people on that side, and they are, one is right and the other is wrong, and they have to sort of duke it out. Men and women and sexist questions, races, and so on. That's the kind of Marxist idea, I think, that you, because he started, of course, with the proletariat, the poor, and the middle class, and he separated them. That used to, at one point, you know, before the French Revolution, there was, to a degree, a kind of cohesive society that was in classes, mm-hmm. like that, and it didn't not work altogether.
Right.
It was not.
Notice the qualifiers there.
Right. It's not that the class system itself made it impossible for people to work together. It was the sin in each person in each of those classes that did, and it was possible for there's to be such a thing as noblesse oblige, for example. You know, the upper class felt an obligation to look after the lower classes. And you see evidence of it in Downton Abbey. Mm. You know, have you ever seen any of the Downton Abbey?
Show? I know what it is, but you know I have not.
Well,
I'm one of those Philistines.
Not at all. I watched it for a while with my wife, and then it got to the point where I couldn't do it anymore. But the time is the First World War, beginning of the 20th century, and you've got a Lord of the Manor kind of guy in this Lord Grantham, and he has a family, and that family has a lot of land, and that land is bordered by a lot of shops, owners, and townspeople, and so on, and farmers, and people like that. And he felt a kind of responsibility to look after them. See, but he's the last of the sort of old generation, in a sense. That's what's being played out. The drama of the show is in a sense how his own children have become more egalitarian,
right.
And how they differ in their and how they sort of wrestle with, right. that. And some of them become Marxists. Marxism, yeah. encourages that sense of egalitarianism.
I mean, I feel like this. The more I look into it, the more I study it. It's like there is this. It seems this really is a problem of the Enlightenment, if I can, mm-hmm. put it that way. Mm-hmm. Because Marxism is a product of the Enlightenment.
Absolutely
it's
right.
It straight up is. It's something that maybe, you know, less read Marxists, which, you know, I need to read more myself, but I feel like, you know, a popular level Marxism would be aghast to feel like they have anything in common with capitalism. But they're both products of the Enlightenment in,
right.
some way.
That's right.
As a matter of fact, you could say the fight between Marxism and capitalism is an in-house squabble rather than a, you know, real true division between the two. And so it's like the Enlightenment comes along and in a very perhaps too simplistic way changes the ground and changes the way we think about things and changes the terminology on things. And there's been something that's been building up all those years. And it seems like whatever was pre-Enlightenment, what I guess Kirk would have called a sort of more Gothic sort of mindset,
mm-hmm.
just, I don't want to say like it didn't have, like it had nothing, because there's been plenty of people who still have. As a matter of fact, there's an argument made that the Catholic Church to this day still is providing an alternative way. I say, right. all this qualifiedly, because, right. of all the problems going on and issues with,
sure.
St. Francis, with St. Francis, Pope Francis.
Right.
Speak ahead of myself there. And all the issues that have been going on with like sex scandals and stuff like,
right.
that. But,
right.
in the intellectual circles, they have things like, philosophically, there's personalism, and economically,
right.
there's distributism.
That's,
and there,
right.
are these things that are neither, you know, classical liberal free market capitalism nor, you know, classical or Gramscian or Althusserian or whatever Marxism. It's like a completely different way of thinking about human beings' culture. So there is a way out there, but it just doesn't seem like it gets the, how shall I say, press,
yeah.
the others do.
Yeah.
And I don't want to be conspiratorial about that either, but somehow trying to positively engage in the culture. So there's like, there's two problems. One is how to do it, and then the other one is how to articulate what you're doing.
Uh-huh.
So that it catches fire, if we could put it that way.
Yeah. Well, the question for the Christian is, should we be engaged with the culture? And I think the answer is yes, since we have some statements in the scriptures to gear us in that direction, like being salt and light and like being in and not of and so on. But then the question is how to do it. And how can I put this? You can't actually live as though there were many cultures. You can't live that way. You can't live like you can create your own subculture and still have an effect on the way the world is. And I think by the effect that the church has had over the course of the many years, and it's a flawed effect, mind you, because it's all sinners that are accomplishing it, but the Lord's accomplishment through the church in the culture is to be a kind of preservative, is to be able to stand against evil when they see it, and to offer solutions that really are sort of political solutions. I mean that in the broadest sense possible, not political parties, but the idea of the polis, that the city is a group of people, the culture is a group of people that have to live in proximity with each other, and they have to figure out how to live in proximity. And we are, our evil bubbles up in that situation at every turn. So the church has had the ability to, and has, I think, successfully held at bay a degree of the onslaught of evil in the culture. And to the degree that the church then withdraws from the common culture, the culture actually goes downhill. Mm-hmm. So we have a certain responsibility, I think, that way to engage. So the question then is, if we don't want to engage negatively, and we know we need to engage, then what does positive engagement look like? Mm-hmm. And I think you mentioned the Catholics and some of their distributivism in the world of economics, personalism in the world of human nature and anthropology and politics in general. There's loads of possibilities, but you're right, they don't get any press. So how do we go about speaking to a culture that has given up its reference point? That's what the Enlightenment, I think, did. It emphasized reason to the point that it left God out of the equation, and God becomes a kind of reference point for, to test against, right? To know whether you're progressing or not, in quotes. You gotta have a fixed point in order to know that you're getting closer to it. Mm-hmm. Well, we dismissed the fixed point, and we cut our reason loose to just wander where it would go, and assumed that it would take us in a good direction. Mm-hmm. And in many cases, of course, it didn't. So how do we speak into a culture now that has long since given up that focal point, that focus point of reference, and do so in a compelling way?
Right. Well, the first thing I would say, like how we do it, because yes, ladies and gentlemen, Hodges and I are going to solve the problem in the next 30 minutes.
It's about time. I mean, this is like our 32nd podcast, so
here we go.
Whatever, 33.
It's about time. I mean,
like we can do that.
I mean, the first thing for me is definitely on the terminological and definitional side, and what I mean by that is we have to deeply care about how we articulate the things that we say.
Right.
How we articulate and explain ourselves. There was, again, not to pick on the MacArthur statement, because I think it was nice and it's good if you signed it. Bravo, mazel tov. But there was something about it that I don't think cavalier is the right word, but there's something about it that almost just seemed to assume everybody would know what it was talking about.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, one of the big criticisms is that it didn't define the terms it was using, and people who were involved with the statement said, that's true, we need to fix that.
Wow.
But it's more than that. There was a sense that, like, the church can, of any stripe, and some church leader of any stripe can make a statement like this, and it just be, in many ways, just almost non-controversially orthodox. Like any like conservative orthodox group would have said exactly these same things,
mm-hmm.
and yet throw that out there and feel like it's going to have the effect. I mean, some of them were surprised by the incredible backlash. They figured it's going to be backlash, but said they were kind of surprised by the vitriol that it got back. And I think some of that vitriol is being taught to believe that anybody disagrees with you is your mortal enemy, but also believing that, how to put this right, there needs to be, I don't know how to say this. It's like, maybe that's part of the problem. There needs to be, all the words that are bouncing around my brain is like not exactly what I'm thinking, but it's like we have to have a cautious or careful or very precise, very calm, very something. I don't know what the word is, but when we state our position, we need to take the time to carefully define and unpack what we mean to explain exactly where we stand. Mm-hmm. You know, and that involves recognizing what the other side is saying and being able to articulate it accurately, not in a straw man fashion.
Right.
And maybe even in some way, even steel manning their position to show I am taking your position seriously. So when I disagree with it, it's not out of any dismissive way. In other words,
that's very important.
Yeah. That's some of the things that often frustrates me on what I'll say our side. I hesitate to say our side because it could be a very diverse and disparate bunch, but the side that's not Marxist or the side that gets tackle raised at the terms of social justice is when we speak, it feels like we're assuming everybody's going to know what we're talking about.
Right. That's right. And that comes across as sort of haughty, doesn't it?
Right. And also you're preaching to the choir.
Right. Now, see, I want to say that can be useful if you really are speaking to the choir.
Yeah.
That's useful. Yeah. You want to clarify for the choir what the choir actually has already agreed to. That's good. That's fine. But if that's the statement that we send to the world, and the people who don't agree to it are reading it for the first time, then it may not be very compelling. In fact, it can be just the opposite. It can be off-putting, can't it?
Right.
So, okay, so maybe there are two statements that we make. We make one to ourselves, but we make one to the watching world. And the steel man argument more and more seems to me is the right way to go. I think I've always been inspired by Thomas Aquinas and his Summa, where I think he does a masterful job of giving you his opponent's opinion in the very best possible light. And it's not because he's trying to be nice or something. It's that he doesn't want to waste his time. You want to argue against the best that the other side has to say, and not just put up a straw man and knock it down and feel good about yourself doing it. Both sides, I think, are guilty of that. So in our case, I think we ought to be looking for ways to straw man, not straw man, obviously, but I guess this idea of steel man, which is a kind of new idea to me, but I mean that term, the idea comes from Thomas, at least in my mind, or is exemplified best in Thomas. But now that I have a term for it, I like it a lot.
Yeah.
I think that's a very good way to do it. It gives the other side dignity, because that's one of the things you want to do. And it also takes their argument fully without wasting everybody's time. To read a straw man argument is to waste your time. Well, what if we pick a subject that we could address? What if we talked about, say, the question of whether or not living together before marriage, which is on the rise, mind you, is a problem for Christians in general, but for on a more social level, does it encourage divorce, for example, or does it encourage poor relations, that kind of thing? Is there a reason? How do we engage with what looks like to me an epidemic almost of living together before marriage in our culture today?
Sure. Yeah, because that one, how to speak into that one, there is a theological reason about why it's not right.
Sure.
When I say theological reason, I almost want to say that really is for the Christian, that's the ultimate reason why it's wrong. It has to do with the way the universe is constructed and the way that God has organized it and set it up the way it is, that it's going to work only this way. The marriage is supposed to be this reflection of all kinds of things, but I mean specifically like Christ and his church, the relationship between God and himself and the Trinity.
Right.
You know, there's this deep metaphysical, ontological thing that marriage is an image of, and that's what it's built to do, is to show that.
That's right.
Is to be a metaphor for that in the truest, deepest sense of what a metaphor is.
And I think that's exactly right. I think and when you say the truest, deepest sense of metaphor, I think you're really onto something, because it's not just that it's a picture of that thing, it's that it actually is that thing, mm-hmm. right? Because when the Trinity, the God of the Trinity, calls us to be to love, to repentance, to walk with Him, to all those things. When He calls us to become Christians, what He's asking us to do is to participate in Him. Mm-hmm. We're not just to sort of be little imitations of Him off in a distance. We're actually supposed to be joining Him in doing love the way He does it. In other words, you see, because that's what love is. So when He says, do marriage this way, He's saying, I want you to be able to not just, in a sense, be a carbon copy of Me to sort of point people to Me. I want you to be Me. I want you to be like Me to such a degree that you experience the truth and the depth and the reality of what love is all supposed to be. And that love is that thing that's gone on amongst the persons of the Trinity for all eternity. Yeah. Right. So that's a tough sell, though, to a society that has decided they don't want that focal point, that theological focal point. Right. So maybe this is the same problem we had with the MacArthur statement being a kind of an appeal to the choir. That argument may solidify and clarify for people who are already committed to Christianity, but it may not do any good for other people.
It'll get a lot of amens, but in the church.
Yeah.
But outside the church, most likely you'll get people that, well, that's nice for you.
Right.
You know, kind of, that's nice for you.
They don't see that.
Or what does your weird religious notion of God have to do with my, you know, who I love and whom I'm with? That type of thing.
It really is.
I'm not sure if, not to backtrack a bit, but in the sense of like the how Christians have engaged the culture and the words I'm trying to find to express what's wrong. It's not that I wish we would play more defense, but I wish we would quit acting like there's so many people out there who want to act like they still have some kind of high place in the culture that they can speak to authoritatively.
Uh-huh.
And I don't think we do.
We're kind of in the minority.
I pretty much buy into the idea of this being a post-Christian America and maybe a post-Christian West. Not that it's gone or that it's not going to have some influence that's significant, but the idea that we have the moral high ground or the moral authoritative cultural voice is gone. It's arguably been long gone, but at the very least, it's gone now.
Right.
And I wish more. I think that's the other thing. This ties into the terminological and the definitional thing. Is we need to act like that's the case, you know, and start
recognize
that reality and start realizing, okay, maybe we can't go when we're engaging the culture. We can't go full, you know, creedal hammer and tongs on people. Right. We have to find a much more not nuanced.
Persuasive.
Something, you know, our speech seasoned with salt. As wise as serpents, gentle as doves. Uh-huh. We are kind of almost back, and it's arguable that one of the problems is we forgot we were always like this. But at the very least, we're back to sheep being sent out among wolves type thing. Mm-hmm. We need that wise as serpents, mm-hmm. gentle as doves. And I don't feel like we have that. We got maybe a lot of wisdom, but... Or maybe a lot of gentleness without wisdom, and a lot of wisdom without gentleness. But the combination of the two seems to be lacking.
Well, just for clarification, you're not saying that the Christian faith itself has somehow lessened. It's just that the influence of it in the culture has lessened to the degree that we don't have that kind of moral.
Yeah, the influence is definitely way lessened.
Right. Yeah, that's what we're both saying that. I think we're both saying that.
So how to articulate? Well, that's the thing. It's like, well, if we can't articulate, we'll say, well, the Christian influence has lessened.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, when it comes to something
but
like
you want us to recognize that, right? Yeah. In the way we address people,
right? And in recognizing that, figure out okay. Well, then how do we address the world, the culture, but as Christians?
Yeah.
That's still a thing.
Still
let the flag fly, because in the situation with like living together, there's this deep theological reason why marriage is what it is, and why all deviations from that, whether you know, premarital sex, extramarital sex, living together, homosexual marriage, divorce outside the bounds of the very specific qualifications that are put down.
Right.
Whatever. You know, all the stuff that's outside, including the most worst extreme examples, like, sure, you know, rape and molestation and stuff like that. The deep theological reason why that's all wrong is because of the image it's supposed to be representing.
That's right.
What marriage is supposed to be, the telos of marriage.
That's right.
All right. And that's not just an argument. That is at bottom, the argument.
Right.
That is it. All right. But we're not in a culture where Christianity has much influence. Okay, well, now how do we argue? There's a temptation, I feel, to fall back on arguments that aren't necessarily Christian. They're not exactly not Christian, but it's more like, well, you know, according to the data,
right?
You know, divorce rates can be higher amongst people who have, like, lived together. It's like, well, divorce, and their response could be like, well, that might not be me.
That's right.
You know, divorce rates are pretty high amongst people who are married anyway. So it's like, right, you know, like, right, who's to say the gamble is going to work either way? It's like there's a temptation to be, well, if the Christian influence isn't there, then the only way to argue is to argue something that really doesn't ultimately rest on a Christian thinking.
Right.
How do you take the telos of marriage found in Christianity and argue it in a way to a post-Christian world that's compelling?
Yeah.
That's the trick.
I think that is what cultural engagement is, finding that piece. If you can't speak convincingly about the theological, that is, you don't have the kind of consensus amongst your audience. This is really a rhetorical question. It's a question of how do you address an audience. If you have to know your audience well enough to know to speak to them in a language that they understand, like Paul on Mars Hill, like you said before. It seems to me there are layers of influence, maybe like rings coming out from a pebble dropped in the water, you know, of influence in the culture from that pebble, from that Christian, in this case, the Christian mindset. But we have to actually engage the culture in the third or fourth ring away from that theology, maybe, or maybe only the second. But it's almost that these two things are the same thing. The idea of how to engage the culture and the specific question of what would be a positive rhetorical device to use are the same question. Mm-hmm. What I mean is this. Let me see if I can offer a suggestion. You can talk on the theological level, but that, as you said, is not going to get hearing. But you can also talk on a kind of level of effect. So you might be tempted to say 33% of, you know, living together couples, cohabitation couples, divorce or something. Give them a statistic. But that statistic is not necessarily compelling, not because the statistic isn't true, but because statistics themselves only tell you so much. They're right. They're not whole truths. They're right. Just
they don't capture
pieces
the
of
entire,
the truth.
They don't capture the entire picture.
That's
right. And they don't grab the nerves and the sinews. You know what I mean?
Well, they can be compelling under certain circumstances, but others they don't. Well, what about a kind of psychological approach? Maybe the second ring out from theology is something philosophical or psychological even. That is like this. Your relationship with your boyfriend, girlfriend, has two elements to it. It has the level of proximity, which is how sexually active, how close you are to each other in terms of living together. Are you living in the same place? Are you living in the same city? Are you living in the same country? You know, a proximity question.
Right.
There's that. And then on the other hand, there's the sort of commitment level that you've made to each other. And those two things are somewhat mutually exclusive. You can be living with somebody that you're not married to, which is what we're talking about here, right? But the marriage is actually the commitment level. Have I decided to swear before my friends and everybody that I'm going to live with this person for the rest of my life? That kind of assertion of commitment is different than the physical proximity I have to the person. My argument is, the psychological argument would be, if you allow your proximity to get ahead of your commitment, then it's hard to pull that back again without stripping gears and breaking hearts and all that stuff.
See? Yeah.
So maybe there's a practical kind of psychological reason or emotional reason why getting ahead of your willingness to be committed is a problem. And could we argue that way? It engages the human, right, and the sinews, as you're talking about, to a degree.
I definitely think it's an argument that could be made, and I also think, as usual, any individual person could always just say, well, that's not going to be us.
Right.
You know, and they can. Everyone always thinks they're sure. the exception to something in
right.
some way.
Right.
And, you know, there's probably a snowball's chance that they are. Maybe they'll be still, maybe they'll do it right. Do you see the quotation marks I'm yes. making with my hands? Maybe there are people
ears.
Out there who will do it right. They lived together for like 10 years and really got to know each other and getting each other, and they know what, you know what, why not get married? We're obviously stable. We're obviously together. Let's get married and just pull the trigger. Have
sure.
a nice ceremony, because that's all marriage is. It's just a ceremony, tie, you know, doing some symbolic things, but why not? Who cares, right? Maybe they do it right and they live a happy, flourishing life at the end of the day. That is by no means always the case, and it does not defeat your argument necessarily.
Uh-huh.
But people will always find, when they, that's the other thing, if they want to do it,
That want is actually the key.
They'll
I
always
think.
Want.
Sure.
It's the idea of positing something else they might want, right? It's like so. Not to poo-poo what you just said, because I'm not. I think your whole like the difference between like how if you have this level of intimacy but no commitment, that creates a whole bunch of problems.
Right.
Here's like one way I would put it, and I think it's putting what you said actually. It's the same thing. It's just in different terms.
Okay.
One of the reasons I, even if I didn't have Christianity, would just find sort of a guttural, visceral no to the idea of like, well, live together instead of doing marriage, is because it just seems so pathetic. Like compared to marriage, it just seems so pathetic.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and this is people could say like, well, that's just, you know, what I'm about to say is my purely sort of subjective thing, and I suppose it is just purely my subjective experience. But, you know, to heck with all of you, I still think it means that I still think it's one of the most compelling thing for me.
Yeah.
Is when I think of marriage, I think of, you know, the prince and the princess came together and through a struggle
sure.
where true love won out, and now they get to live to be with each other in a true loving commitment that's built on this strong bond, and that's
right.
like really romantic and deep and so on and so forth, and you know, seeing, you know, not just the they live happily ever after, but seeing that even like play out and work out. I always hate it when TV shows do a great job of like building up these two people to come together romantically, and then
and
the next season they're like, well, what do we do with their character? I know, completely destroy the relationship.
Ooh,
it's like,
ooh,
come
yeah.
on.
Right.
But so marriage has this image of like true like romance and commitment and love and loyalty and sacrifice for each other. Living together?
Yeah.
There was this, I can't remember what show it was. I want to say it was House, but I don't think it was. But there were these two characters. They weren't main characters, but they were like dating, but there was this question of like, are we going to live together? Because that's like the next big step of the commitment.
Right.
And something about it just seemed so lame.
Yeah.
It compared to like, you know, the sacrifice for joy and the romance. The fact that like we can't even decide if we even want to live together compared to I killed a dragon to like wake you up.
Right.
Just
right.
seemed utterly preposterous to me.
Right.
And I can never forget there was this episode in this episode when they finally decided, yes, the guy, it was like, I don't know, like her birthday or something, and he got her a gift. And the gift he got is he had taken one of the drawers out of like his dresser and had wrapped it up. Give her the drawer to show her, like, you can come live with me.
You can come and have
and
your own drawer.
This is your drawer.
I love it.
This is your drawer. And I suppose it was supposed to be sweet.
Yeah.
But I just found it so stupid. I'm like, that's it? That's what you have to offer is a
where's
drawer.
Where's the dragon's head?
Like, where's the,
where's the gold ring?
That can seem really, really, to other people that may seem really silly, but quite frankly, if I had no religion, I still would not be interested in just cohabitation, because it seems so lame compared to the real thing. The real thing, and I mean that purposely, the real thing, real romance, real love, is bound up in that commitment. If you're just living together, then I'm like, how, you guys, where's the loyalty? Where's the love? Where's the proof in the pudding that you actually are sacrificially in love with each other when you can't even do the thing that is supposed to maintain you guys together. Anyway, you know what I'm saying?
I know exactly what you're saying, and I think you're really onto something there that is the extension of what I was talking about a second ago, which is this idea of cohabitating. I think that they want to cohabitate in order to figure out whether or not they are right for each other.
Yeah, taking
and steps. That's that sort of milksoppy kind of commitment level. They're all hesitating, sort of.
They're hedging their bets.
Exactly. But I think there's another problem with it, and that is, I mean, I'm completely with you about the romance part of it, the true romance part of it, the true dragon-slaying kind of romance. But this is, I think they have a naive view of knowing each other, because they actually think that if they spend time together cohabitating, they'll learn more about each other and be able to make the decision as to whether they want to be married. But I think it's the other way around. Well, first of all, before I say it's the other way around, I think that having been married now for 34 years, I'm still learning about my wife. At the time that we got married, compared to the amount of time we knew each other then and now, of course, is no comparison. The knowledge I have about her now is based on 34 years of being married to each other. To think that I could know her well enough before I got married that I was completely comfortable is a bit naive, right?
It's absurd.
It's for married people looking backward, it's absurd. For people who are not married looking forward, it's a kind of naivete. It's a lack of experience, right, to be able to say, well, I need more time to really know her thoroughly before I decide whether I'm going to marry. But here's the thing. It's the actual marriage that makes it possible for me to know her. It's not the other way around. So before marriage, I can't know her. Here's why. I think you have to be able to have a commitment to each other for life and trust that the other one meant it before you can open up enough to be who you really are around them and let them know who you are. Let the other person know who you are. It's a kind of, I call it radical surgery, I think, that God is doing on us. He's actually diving deeper and deeper and deeper into us and exposing more and more of us in this work of sanctification. And marriage is one of the ways that he pulls it off, because only in marriage can you trust the other person enough to allow them to get close enough to you to know you as you are. So you're right when you talk about being before marriage. Even sex before marriage is not really sex. It's not really the thing. Right. I read an article that said it's more like the Disney version of a forest, you know, instead of a real wilderness.
Right.
Once you get married, then the marriage commitment makes it possible for you to have the intimacy that we call sex. Mm. But beforehand, it's a lame, maybe fireworks like, but still lame,
a cheap imitation.
Imitation,
right,
of the real thing. So, in a sense, when I hear people say, well, the argument for cohabitation is we want to know each other better before we make the commitment, I want to say, why don't you just get married now then, make the commitment, and then you can get to know each other. And if you at that point you say, well, hang on, I'm not ready to do that, then I want to say then you're not ready to cohabitate either.
Right. See, I think we may have stumbled onto something with the idea, a way to engage the culture as Christians would be effective against their stuff, so to speak. I think this way of saying, if I could put it this way of saying that's just lame, yeah, is a way of like engaging. It's different than saying, you know, well, that's wrong. Or like this theological,
right,
it's
right,
a different kind of argument.
It's not a moralism.
It's kind of like when in the past we've come to the conclusion when we've read some more progressivist, Marxist influenced, you know, liberation or social gospel stuff, that despite all our issues with it, one of the main issues we have, and we've said this before, one of our main issues with it is that it's not radical enough.
Right.
Right? That it's
right,
like, it still wants to say, well, Jesus, you know, forgives and saves and redeems everyone except those mean white supremacist oppressors. Like, no, Jesus washed their feet too.
Yeah.
Right? Jesus died for and rose for them too. Like, it's not that you're, you know, these crazy hippie kids who need to get off our lawn. Is that you're lame?
Yeah, right.
Compared to actual Jesus, you're pathetic.
Yeah.
It's like it's boiled to rags. It's like, I remember, again, the bad Catholic guy, Mark Barnes, who's great. But he wrote, I mentioned this before, he wrote an essay about pornography because he's part of groups that, like, fight that stuff, like mm-hmm. porn kills love and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he wrote an essay. He said there's lots of arguments against pornography that are good, but the one that needs to be introduced and really stressed is not just that it's immoral or destructive to your innocence, but that also it's pathetic. It's like it's
right.
in the sense that it's beneath you.
Right. Exactly. Right?
There's a whole world of actual sexual intimacy out there for you in the realm of like actual marriage and stuff, and you're settling for this Disney version of
exactly.
it. If I could put it, it's another
right.
Disney. It's another fake version.
Facade.
I say that advisedly because I just talked about you know the slaying of the dragon and stuff like that.
No, that's real though.
That's based on something.
It happens that Disney has absorbed that and tried to abuse it.
Yeah, but it's something deeper than Disney.
Oh, yeah.
It's like it's the same, but it's the same kind of argument as that. Man, it's like the thing is just lame compared to this other thing. I felt like, and for the life of me, and I feel like I should hand in my card on this, but I know Chesterton did this all the time, and for the life of me, I can't think of a concrete example. But he would do this all the time when he was arguing against something. He wouldn't just prove like the irrationality of it and even the absurdity of it,
right.
but in some ways the patheticness of I shouldn't doubt myself.
You can think of it.
In the Orthodoxy, when he like finishes with the two chapters, The Madman and The Suicide of Thought, which
right.
is his little sort of attack on rationalism, and then his attack on skepticism,
right?
You know, which is sort of like a putting reason in its right place combined together. He ends The Suicide of Thought with sort of these two images that are sort of the suicide of thought. One is Nietzsche and one is for him Tolstoy, because they both represent something.
Mm-hmm.
And Nietzsche represents the sort of fiery desire to like have everything, and Tolstoy represents this sort of pacifist Buddhist like detachment from everything.
Yeah.
And both of those are the destruction of thought, because thought is a decisive moment, like where you make, I'm thinking this and now I'm going to act this way.
Right.
But his final argument against them is comparing them to Joan of Arc.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And talking about how Nietzsche admired warfare and warriors. Joan of Arc was a warrior.
Right.
And how Tolstoy admired poverty and, you know, thought it was sublime or something, but Joan of Arc was poor
mm-hmm.
and actually, you know, lived in poverty, actually fought battles, and she actually made a decision and went thunderously down. And the way he describes it makes you look like, look, I don't know if I agree with all this Christian stuff, but the way he's describing it, I want to be with Joan of Arc, not with Nietzsche or Tolstoy, or those two viewpoints.
Right? Right.
Sorry, apologies to people who are fans of Tolstoy, but he was using it as, or Nietzsche for that matter, but he was using them as images of something. And
that wasn't
his only argument. But it was part and parcel with his entire argument.
And there's blood and sap and sinew and life and vibrancy and
and
danger in all of that that appeals to a real heart, I think. So it occurs to me that this kind of approach to say cohabitation and marriage and so on is an engagement with the culture at a level of the psychological or the philosophical or something. But it seems to me that we should be able to draw a line from a theological position to the benefits psychologically or philosophically or whatever in the socially, even in the culture, like a line through the maze, you know, or breadcrumbs that could lead you back to the theological position. Maybe the way to engage is to make those connections yourself and then speak at the other end of the connection. That is where the connection really, where the rubber meets the road, where the society actually addresses the problem.
Right.
And then leave that gap, that string available, the breadcrumbs, whatever metaphor you want to use, available so that they can actually walk it back to see why it connects up with Christianity. Now, here's the problem. Not every theological position, not every faithful position is going to immediately end in some kind of good for the society, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So Christians have to be willing to be faithful to what they know is true, even if they don't see the benefit in the society. But I think most of the time we can draw a line to benefits, right? And like I'm trying to draw this one. If you are a sexually promiscuous society, then sexual fulfillment is a higher good than the emotional. They're not thinking about the emotional and psychological sort of aspect of it all that's going to be hard to walk back, as I said. If you get too involved physically and then you want to break it off, well, then it's very painful, right? Where it's a lot less painful if you've only been on a few dates and you haven't been all that physically involved right. with each other, and you find you're not compatible, not for each other. I think you can draw the connection between what a healthy marriage looks like in a theological perspective and what a healthy emotional relationship looks like here. But if your priorities are out of whack in this world, then it's hard to make that case. Their emotions are actually driving them, and what they want is what they want, and they don't want you to stand in the way. It just seems like oppression to tell them not to live together ahead of time. But the Christian needs to be able to say not just, well, this is what the Bible says, but he has to be able to say, this is the outcome of what the Bible says without talking about the Bible. This is actually the societal impact on you and on your prospective spouse and on your clarity of mind and all those things that matter. So I guess what I'm saying is that cultural engagement is going to have to be the hard work of taking those theological principles and working them out into the warp and woof of the society in a positive way, and then make your case. You know, you have to stand before Congress and make a case for a particular law. You're not going to be saying, because in Psalm 27 it says blah, blah, blah. Right. You've got to be able to tell them the practical aspect of this without becoming pragmatic. That is, switching your criteria to whatever works is good, which is what pragmatism is. But rather saying, this is the good of this position, where in the back of your mind you're always saying, I know where it came from.
Right. I think that to accomplish an engagement like that would require the individual Christian, the church as a whole, quite frankly, but each individual Christian themselves, to have at least two things going on in their lives. One is they have to have a rich faith.
Mm.
All right? It can't just be, there is in American Christianity a lot of shallowness.
Very superficial.
Shallow. It doesn't have the depths. It doesn't have the theological depths, the philosophical depths, the cultural depths, the artistic and beatific depths. It just doesn't have any of it. It's very surface level.
Right.
If you're listening, you're like, well, how can I effectively engage in a culture? You need two things. The first one is you need to steep yourself in the depths of your faith. You need to read scripture all the time, but you need to read commentators and theologians and great thinkers and philosophers and mystics and whoever of the Orthodox faith, Orthodox faith. You need to steep yourself in the great thinkers. You don't need to get a PhD in theology or philosophy, all right? If you just find one deep thinker and stick with them,
mm-hmm.
whether it's, you know, C.S. Lewis or St. Maximus the Confessor or something
mm-hmm.
like that,
mm-hmm.
whatever, just start with one and just steep yourself into deep thoughts of the faith. You have to be immersed in what is the creedal, scriptural, orthodox faith, the thing that's been handed down for 2,000 years and has developed a rich legacy of thinking and of art. You need to be steeped in your faith.
Right.
You cannot have a shallow faith. You got to know what you believe and why you believe it and why the thing is beautiful. So that's one. The other thing you need is you need to be steeped in the language of the culture you're in.
Right.
And that's not just, you know, knowing English. You need to understand why Marvel movies are so popular.
Right.
You need to understand, you know, why Marxism gets apart. I'm applying this to my own self too. It's not just, you know, advice to everyone else. My dissertation is involved reading a lot of Marxist stuff and a lot of church fathers on Trinitarian theology. Like that, those two things. Because I need to find a response to this Marxist stuff that is fully Christian. So what do I need to do? Well, I need to read the Marxists.
Right.
You know, I have in my book list, I have Marx, and I have Gramsci, and I have Frankfurt School guys, and I have Althusser, and I have Terry Eagleton, and I have Slavoj Zizek. I have all these people. and other various like offshoots from them, you know, that were influenced by them, whether it be third wave feminism or queer theory or critical race theory or postcolonialism or whatever.
Right.
You got to read that stuff, or I have to read that stuff, right? But I also need to read, well, if I'm not going to believe that, then what am I going to believe? Well, where's the Christian stuff, right? Mm-hmm. So it's those two pillars. You have to be deeply steeped in your faith. You have to have a deep faith, and you have to understand the language of the culture. Why does Marxism catch fire so easily?
Hmm.
Okay, is it just because everybody is a degenerate, you know, sleeper cell agent for the cultural Marxists who live in their, the cultural Marxists is just a cabal of like 12 people who live in the apartment penthouse in New York that's all smoky with cigar smoke, and they all stand around like, how can we destroy the Republic today? Or something like that. Or do they catch on to it because it has something that needs to be addressed?
Right.
Something needs to be dealt with. Why is it that Disney has such power? Or why is it that old fairy tales have such power? Or the Lord of the Rings or Harry Potter or whoever?
Sure.
Why are certain TV shows popular? You know, why is certain music consider good music or bad? Why is certain pop music effective and not effective? Why are video games such a big thing? You need to, again, you don't need a PhD in this stuff, and sometimes it just means finding one thing and fixing on it, all right? But you have to have those two pillars. You got to have a deep faith, and you have to be steeped in the language of the culture you're in.
I think those are two very good points, and I think the second is very complicated to do because of the fact that we have such a diverse culture now. So it may be that we need a church rather than an individual.
Mm-hmm.
So the individual can't actually be steeped in all of the language of the culture.
Yeah.
But maybe between us we can be, among us we can be. And then each of us takes a piece of it and then becomes a kind of authority to speak into that particular aspect of it, and yet stays in his community, so he's in the world and yet not of it. Yeah, I agree. I think those are the two key elements. That's good. We have the need to be heard in a way that the culture around us can hear. So it requires that we know their language and their definitions of things so that we know how we're being heard. And that's the second part, I think, of what you were just describing. But the first part is extremely important, too. And I think that's maybe... I'd like to think at the center we're doing both of those, but I think we maybe emphasize the first one a little bit in the sense that we're looking at the past and the repository of art and music and poetry and theology and philosophy and so on of the past to get a good solid foundation to be able to speak to our own day in a way that makes sense. One of the elements of the kind of modernist or postmodernist life we see lived out around us is a reluctance to engage with the past. That is, the past doesn't really have any bearing on the future in their minds, and so we want to be free from all those mistakes that people have made in the past. We don't, in a sense, reinvent the wheel every generation, and I think that's a very bad idea. In that, not only do you lose out on the benefits of the wisdom of the past, but you lose out on the benefits of the foolishness of the past, too. Because a lot of the foolishness that's being promulgated today is not original to this generation.
Right.
It's just because they're ignorant of how people have done it in the past. So the old adage that if you don't know history, you're doomed to repeat it. What they mean is if you don't know the history of failures, that you're doomed to repeat the failures. I think that makes some sense. So... We need to know the Shakespeare plays, and we need to know Dante, and we need to know the music of the great composers and the philosophy of the great philosophers, if for no other reason than to say that's not a good way to do it. But you can't make that assessment unless you've learned it first. In the same way that you can't speak into the culture today if you don't learn the language of today. So you need both ends of that. That's a very good way to put that, I think, Jack. Well, I guess we better wrap up.
Sure.
Let's. Do we have any recommendations? Do you want to recommend something?
Yes. What do you have?
I'm going to recommend a webinar that I'm doing myself.
Ah.
How's that? It's the fifth in a series of five webinars on music that I'm doing, and it'll be done through the Searcy organization. The CRC Institute is a classical education organization that I do some things with. Great folks. Mm-hmm. And they have asked me to do this, and I'm doing it on their through their website. You can talk to the CRC people directly, crcinstitute.org. And they will hook you up. But the likelihood is that our podcast right now won't be available until after that event. But that doesn't mean that you can't listen to it anyway. And so you can take a listen. But it's specifically about popular music. You know, I'm a classical guy. I've studied classical music, and so I've played a lot of popular music, but I've never studied it exactly. So I'm doing my best. I did four episodes on music, early music, medieval, Renaissance, Baroque, and Enlightenment kind of period music, all the way into the 20th century. I guess I did the 20th century last time. So I thought it's no good just talking about the classical sort of high culture music of the 20th century. The popular music of the 20th century is extremely influential, and it needs to be addressed. So I'm going to spend an hour and a half talking about the roots of popular music in the 20th century and get as close to Beyonce as I can in terms of time, chronology. Not proximity, but chronology.
Oh, I got it.
And so anyway, that's coming up next week, and I hope that it will be of use to people. I'm going to be talking about popular music.
Well, I said that you need to be steeped in your faith, in the depths of your faith, and sometimes it's hard for Protestants, because for a lot of Protestants, the faith, you know, began with Martin Luther and moved forward.
Right.
So what I'm going to recommend is a publishing agency called St. Vladimir Seminary Press.
Oh, yeah, I know it well.
And St. Vladimir, and Vladimir is spelled exactly like you would think it would be. St. Vladimir Seminary Press is a Eastern Orthodox outfit, and they publish nothing but old church fathers, from St. Gregory of Nazianzus to Tertullian and Cyprian and
Basil the Great.
Basil the Great.
Gregory
the Great. St. John of the Cross. All kinds of things. Maximus the Confessor.
Mm-hmm.
Simeon the Theologian. If you're looking for a place to dive in, check out, just go to like Amazon and like type out Vladimir Press or St. Vladimir Press or something like that, and it'll begin to show you stuff. And just pick on one of the books, and they'll say other people bought this or whatever, and it has all kinds of other books. They have a huge catalog. Or you can just go probably to stvladimirpress.com or whatever directly,
sure,
and check out their catalog. If you're looking for a place for the church fathers or for like the history of the church that goes, you know, deep into the depths of it, back into its deep history, that's a good place to start. I found lots of good stuff there.
Yes, we kind of swapped sides there, didn't we? I'm usually doing the old stuff, and you're the guy who wants to talk about the Marvel universe or whatever. And now I'm doing the popular, and you're doing that.
We're steeped in both. I think that's a good thing.
That's wise. Well, I'm glad you're doing that. That's a very good suggestion. So, thanks very much to everybody for listening,
and we will see you next time.